Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, Senior Clinician in Rabbit and Exotic Animal Medicine and Surgery at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, Jenna Richardson. Thank you, Jenna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, hi there. Thanks for the introduction. So firstly, hello and welcome to this afternoon's webinar on dental disease in rodents. As said, my name is Jenna Richardson and I am a lecturer and clinician up at Edinburgh's Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, and I work in the rabbit and exotic animal department. Our rodent caseload is high, and dental disease is certainly something that we're seeing commonly in some of our domestic rodent species. So the overview for this afternoon's webinar includes looking at the classification of the different rodent species we're going to cover. We will have a recap on the differing dental anatomies between the species of rodents, including the dental formulas. Also thinking about their natural diets and how that plays an important role in maintaining good dental health. Then in a more practical setting, looking at the clinical signs that we can expect to see when dentition becomes problematic for our patients. And then there's a few tips that I can impart on how to make the most of the conscious dental examination, and also a review of what equipment is useful to have in practice. And then to finish up, we'll discuss the diagnostic investigations and treatment options and a recap on prevention as well, which is obviously one of the most important parts, preventing our patients from getting dental disease in the first place. So rodents make up the largest order of mammals. There are over 2,200 species of rodents. However, in the UK, we obviously keep a much smaller selection domesticated as pets. The word rodent, just a bit of interest, but it's derived from the Latin word meaning to gnaw. And this is largely thanks to the long chisel-shaped incisors possessed by rodents that are excellent for chewing and gnawing. And the incisor role is one shared by all of our pet rodent species. There are five suborders of rodents, however, we're only really focusing on two of those today, the histricomorphs and the myomorphs, but actually mostly the histricomorphs, as these are the species that we tend to see as the most common candidates presenting with dental problems. So, as I said, the histricomorphs tend to be overrepresented when it comes to dental disease. And that can possibly be explained by a mixture of their constantly growing incisors, premolars and molars, along with the provision of an often very inappropriate diet. The histricomorphs themselves, they can be separated into family groups. We have the Chinchillidae, for example, with chinchilla. Cavidae, for example, guinea pigs and capybaras, and Octodontidae, which the Daegu is included in that. And just as an aside, the Octodontidae, Daegus actually have a figure of eight pattern to their molars on the occlusal surface, and it sort of gives them the name Octodontidae, meaning the eight-toothed rodent, so part of the reason why they're called that. From the myomorphs, the families include Muridae, which is our pet rat and mice, and Cricidae, which the family includes hamsters and gerbils. Now, we aren't going to cover as much information on the myomorphs, although dental disease is seen in these species, but it's usually related to more the incisors rather than the cheek teeth. So chinchilla, guinea pigs and daegus all have continually erupting incisors, premolars and molars. And like rabbits, their teeth can be considered elodont, so they have no anatomical root. The entire tooth is therefore referred to as the reserved crown. Unlike rabbits, rodents only have one pair of upper and lower incisors, so they don't have peg teeth. And chinchilla and daegu incisors are usually yellow in coloration, while guinea pigs are white. The incisors, as you would expect, they're chisel-shaped, and you can see the photo of the guinea pig skull on the left there. You can see quite clearly the lower incisors always sit behind the upper incisors when at rest. The occlusal plane is oblique, and you can see that in the photo on the right, that diagonal angle of the occlusal surface. And in these three species, the diet is extremely important to ensure adequate wear of these constantly growing teeth. So just to show you the similarities between the species, here we have two, well, almost identical small mammal skulls, the top one being a chinchilla, and the lower one being a guinea pig. You can clearly see how far back the lower incisors are set from the upper incisors. So from the incisors to be in occlusion, the rodent must pull forward the lower mandible so that the two cutting edges of the incisors meet. The skull morphology really is very typical of a true herbivore. So we have that very big diastema. If we just have our little arrow here, so we can see, you know, very big diastema at this point. And certainly for the hystricomorphs, the dental formula, they have 20 teeth in total. The dental formula is 1-1. So that's just pop that little arrow away for a moment. So the dental formula, we've got 1-1, which is your upper and your lower incisors on both sides. 0-0, because we don't have canines. But then 1-1 again, which is the upper and lower premolars. And 3-3, which is your upper and lower molars. So 1-1, 0-0, 1-1, 3-3. And what I would say is when you are performing dental examinations on your patients under anaesthetic, there are a number of sources online you can Google to get dental maps of guinea pig and chinchilla mouths, which can be useful for documenting what you're finding and also scanning and putting on the patient file. So how does the myomorph dentition vary? Well, it varies in terms of the molars. They have a limited period of growth, unlike the hystricomorphs where they're constantly growing. The molars are short-crowned. They have these long and quite narrow tooth roots, so we call them brachiodont for that reason. And each mandibular tooth root is in occlusion with the corresponding maxillary cheek tooth. And the rat skull shown here is obviously very similar to the hystricomorph skulls that we were seeing. In terms of the dental formula for myomorphs, so a little bit different. They have fewer teeth, so they lack the premolars. So we have the dental formula of 1-1, which is your upper and lower incisors. 0-0, because no canines. 0-0 again, because no premolars. And then 3-3, because we have three upper and lower molars. So rats and mice have 16 teeth, so four less than the hystricomorphs. Now we said diet is obviously, you know, very important. And if we group together the hystricomorphs with the guinea pigs, chinchillas and daegus, they're all South American species. And thinking about what an appropriate diet is, we think about where they're found in the wild. So they're sort of in the area around the sort of Andes mountain range. Guinea pigs and daegus originate from Chile, whereas the chinchillas are a bit more diffusely spread, being found in sort of Peru, Bolivia and Argentina. All species utilise a varied habitat. Guinea pigs and daegus live in your grasslands and your scrubland. Chinchillas tend to be in more mountainous regions. But due to these habitats, it really should be unsurprising that their diets are exclusively plant material, which is very high in fibre, but often of a very poor quality. They therefore need to eat good quantities, so high large quantities of this high fibre forage, not only to maintain their body weight, but obviously in turn that greatly helps to keep their wear of their teeth very appropriate. So when we try to replicate the natural diet in our pet hystricomorphs, we want food with low energy content so they're not getting full up too soon and not leading to obesity. We want it very high in fibre, and a tough consistency is always good for the chopping and grinding required by the teeth to process the food. So it is worth remembering always, you know, a good diet, it's a bit of a package deal, not just important for dental health, but also for gastrointestinal health as well. And we should be mindful in our captive species, particularly guinea pigs, of the amount of calcium that we're feeding in the diet. Guinea pigs in particular do seem quite prone to urolithiasis, and obviously feeding a higher calcium diet can predispose to calculi developing. So what is a sort of ideal diet that we should be advising our owners? Well, good quality hay or grass, and that can be fed in your ad lib quantities. And really as many tricks as you can impart to your clients for how to promote hay eating in their pets. So placement of hay in lots of different areas in the enclosure, frequent additions of new handfuls of hay throughout the day to renew the interest. Equally, finally chopping your treat-like items, so herbs for example, and sprinkling that through the hay can all help encourage foraging behaviour. Now, like with rabbits, muesli diet should always be avoided, pelleted diets used instead, in small amounts. You know, we're not wanting to feed large quantities, and you know, 5 grams a day is more than enough for most hystricomorph species. There are many commercial diets available, and obviously with guinea pig pellets they add vitamin C to those, but you also can buy specific chinchilla and degu diets now as well. The one thing I would say is, for those of you that are eagle-eyed, the picture of the chinchilla there, you'll see that there is muesli in that bowl. Now, if you have a patient that comes in to you sick, last thing I would do is change the diet at that point. So keep them on their usual diet while in the hospital, and once they're feeling a little bit better, then you can start with the diet transition. One other very important point to say is, as part of our hystricomorphs, that includes our degus, and there is a definite link between the overfeeding of sugary foods and the development of diabetes mellitus in degus. So it's therefore very important that we stick to the high fibre diets and avoid, you know, the addition of fruits or yogurt drops, which unfortunately are often very well marketed, and owners can buy them without realising they're doing any harm. So again, very much worthwhile to be relaying this information to clients. So myomorph diets, well, they're very different to the herbivorous nature of the hystricomorphs. They can be really considered omnivores, and certainly in the wild, you know, your rats and your mice, they're very opportunistic with what they'll happen upon and eat. There are numerous commercial diets available, many of which for the myomorphs are actually muesli diets. And we tend not to get quite as excited about feeding muesli mixes to our myomorph species. And that's mainly because we don't tend to see the same repercussions of the development of dental disease as we do in our rabbits, our guinea pigs, chinchillas and degus. And possibly this is because, you know, the molar teeth do not grow continuously. Also, the overall life expectancy is much shorter in these species. And usually the problems we do see with diet are more related to obesity, which manifests. So generally, I do recommend commercial complete diets for the myomorphs, but it's not the battle I would pick if they're happily eating their cereal mixes. So in terms of the dental diseases that we see in both groups, well, the as we said earlier, the hystricomorphs, they tend to be overrepresented with the dental disease. they're very similar to rabbits in a lot of ways, in that most of the cases are preventable. A lot, if they're detected early, can either be reversed or resolved just by improving the diet. But when you get your moderate and advanced dental disease, that's when it becomes a management issue. That's when we have to have the regular dentals and vet visits. So the most common reason we see in hystricomorphs is inadequate dietary fibre resulting in changes to the dentition. Molar problems in the myomorphs, so that's actually quite an unusual problem to see. However, incisor issues, we do see those with some frequency. Our rats, our mice, hamsters, gerbils, we can see them chewing on bars, we can see them having tumbles and falls when they've been climbing, and even the pottery bowls that get put in, if they take a notion to try and move those, then we can see injury with fractures to the incisors. And just like as you would expect in other species, if you have a fractured incisor, the growth angle can then change. So the incisor, even once it grows back into its normal length, it may not then meet the opposing incisor and we get malocclusion. So in cases like this, we do see that they can often require frequent trips to the vets for dental burring. So if we think now with our clinical hats on, what are the clinical signs that we see of dental disease? Well, it's all quite common sense really, but it's worth having a recap just so that, you know, if you are seeing a chinchilla coming in and the owner's described in the clinical history that, you know, their appetite is a lot reduced, then that could be a sign that we've got pain in the mouth and therefore we're not wanting to eat. Sometimes these patients are actually extremely hungry. You know, they're just physically incapable of eating. So they're wasting away in front of your eyes, become very, very thin, but extremely keen if they're getting the offered liquid critical care food. Often they'll suck on that and swallow lots of that down rather than the tedious task of chewing hay. Salivation, so again, if there's discomfort in the mouth, if you've got spikes or infection in the mouth, we can see an increase to the salivation, and that can be subtle with just the commissures of the mouth appearing a little bit wetter, or like in this chinchilla's case, it can be really quite marked, extending down the chest onto the forepaws and even down, further down the ventrum as well. Anything that, you know, signifies pain as well. And there are many both subtle signs and not so subtle signs. So, you know, the animal might sit quite lethargic with teeth grinding noises. They may, especially in those that are quite dexterous on the forelimbs, they may be pawing at the mouth. As I said, reduced activity as well. And then just like with rabbits, the hystricomorphs can often present from a sort of stress-induced gut stasis as well. A mixture of reduced food intake and the stress of the discomfort and the pain. Those that are previously been very friendly, used to having their ears rubbed, their forehead stroked, they could become head shy, and these are all things that the owners may report. Other clinical signs, so weight loss, and that's something that owners often may not pick up on. However, if there is a companion animal, then sometimes a size disparity can then become quite more apparent. And I do always advise my owners to weigh their pets once a week, have a Friday Weight Watchers type class where, you know, the weights are recorded on a calendar, and that way the owner's able to document these things. So certainly for, you know, your involved owners, a weekly weight check for the pets is a good idea. Just using kitchen scales and have them sitting in a little box while you do that. Other clinical signs to go through, so similar to rabbits with ocular discharge, if you've got disruption of incisor roots or crowns, I should say, then we can see pressure being put on affecting the drainage of the tear duct. So we can see overspill with epiphora and discharge from the eyes. If the mouth is sore, then the overall grooming can reduce, so we can see poor coat quality with dirty bottoms developing as well. Halitosis, so if the owner, you know, is getting quite close to the animal, they may notice an odour coming from it from infection within the mouth. And obviously leading on from spurs and infection, we can see abscessation, so then you can get quite obvious and impressive facial swelling, so this little chap on the bottom right with a very obvious abscess related to one of the molars. So in terms of the dental conditions that we see, usually they are acquired and usually from inappropriate diet or sometimes traumatic episodes. Now that trauma can be self-induced by the animal from an accident, or it should really be very much remembered that any inappropriate veterinary treatment can actually potentially lead to or worsening of dental disease. So we don't advocate clipping of teeth and certainly not rasping of teeth either. The forces put on the roots from those actions are very percussive. We can see fractures, we can see loosening of the periodontal ligament, and that can all lead to infection and abscessation and loosening of the teeth. So when we do have malocclusion or a lack of wear, we can see that developing to create overgrowths with spurs, leading to oral trauma, which can then result in abscess development. So how do we make our diagnosis from this? Well, the history, you know, the owners will often describe some of the clinical signs. Obviously, clinical examination, which we won't go through some of that today, but we will discuss conscious oral examination. Clinical signs, as we have just been through. And then for the oral examination, really there's two ways of looking at that. So one is conscious while in the consult room, often with the owner present. The other is for a more thorough look under a general anaesthetic. Oral endoscopy is extremely useful. And to be honest, even if you don't have access to an endoscope, if you are looking in the mouth under general anaesthetic, I will often use an otoscope then as well, just for increased magnification. Taking radiographs to assess the reserved crown, so the root we'll call it, looking at the overall integrity of the skull, checking for presence of osteomyelitis. And then if you're lucky enough to have the facilities or be close enough for a referral, then CT scan. And certainly that's always the gold standard imaging mode modality for examination of dentition. So jumping to the conscious oral examination. So this is something that, you know, I teach my students. You can actually tell a lot from a conscious examination of the pet. So for most myomorphs, realistically, you can only really have a look at the incisors with them conscious. And that's certain individuals. So, you know, you're gently parting the lips, having a look, quick look often at the incisors. They can often be quite wiggly as patients. So I tend to use either a paper towel or a thin tea towel, popped over the top of them, using my thumb and forefinger as a sort of cuff around the neck. And that way I'm supporting the spine of the body against the palm of my hand, but I have control of the head to provide my fingers with a bit of protection, because obviously they can give a bit of a nasty bite if they want to. And so with them gently restrained, they usually feel more secure and they'll often hold still. To look at the cheek teeth of a myomorph, I do recommend a quick general anaesthetic. It's a bit less stressful for the patient, and it does increase your chances of being sure about what you're seeing. And if you're obviously really struggling with a fast and wriggly patient, then a short inhalation anaesthetic can also allow better access for your incisor examination and treatment. So the photo on the left there, that shows a little Syrian hamster, Boo, he was called, under anaesthetic, and that was just to examine the lower incisor overgrowth and allow for some dental burring. He was a bit of a wriggler. For hystricomorphs, the examination of the incisors is usually extremely straightforward and really easy to perform in pretty much all patients when they're conscious. You can see with this guinea pig on the right, there is an incisor problem. However, that indicates really that we have a primary cheek tooth problem, or at least a suspicion of it. So the area of concern in this particular animal was the left side of the mouth. So what we found was that the guinea pig was chewing at an angle, favouring the right side, which was the more comfortable side to chew on. And so the wear of the incisors demonstrate this sort of diagonal cutting angle. And the left side had a molar overgrowth with dental spike extending into the gingiva. So sometimes looking at the incisors can give you a bit of an idea as to what is going on with the cheek teeth. So then a bit of a strange combination of things on this next slide, but to examine the cheek teeth in your hystricomorphs, so this is your chinchillas, guinea pigs, degus. So I usually have the owner hold their pet in a towel, in a burrito. And again, a thin piece of cloth is important. So thin sheet, you know, pillowcase or tea towel is really ideal. If the owner is unable to hold the animal, then obviously an experienced nurse is ideal. But usually I'm quite happy owner's been present to watch this. For the chinchilla and degu, you can usually see the premolar and molars with the aid of an otoscope fairly clearly. But for the guinea pigs, they're quite amazing in how much food that they hold in the mouth. So there'll be last night's dinner and some of this morning's breakfast. So really, to make sense of what you're seeing, you have to spend a little bit of time before you look with the otoscope to remove the food material from the mouth before attempting to look. So the patient is securely wrapped in the towel burrito, just in ventral recumbency, so the normal sitting position. I advise the owner, particularly with guinea pigs, that they will squeal when having their mouth examined. They squeal for most other parts of their clinical examination as well. But if the owner isn't pre-warned about this, then they can find it a little bit alarming. So always pre-warn that it's not going to be sore for them, but that they will object regardless. I use damp cotton buds, so just wet with tap water, and usually you need anywhere from 5 to 10 cotton buds, double-sided, gently inserting into the mouth and sweeping out the food material. You have to take care that they don't bite the cotton bud in half with the incisors, so always insert through the diastema. And I do one of two things with the cotton bud. So number one, I run it down the medial aspect of the cheek teeth over the tongue. So we'll just get our little arrow back again. So this is a mandible of a guinea pig. And what we've got is overgrowth of certainly the lower first premolar on first side and the first and second molars also. Now we have then got in a live guinea pig, a tongue that sits here, and what these do is they cause entrapment of the tongue. So if you're inserting your cotton bud over the tongue, first of all, the tongue normally wiggles about a lot trying to work out what's in the mouth, making sense of the cotton bud. But when you gently run the cotton bud down, it should smoothly come straight out the mouth. If it's sticking, then that's a good sign that we've maybe got some overgrowth, maybe even some entrapment to the tongue, and not smooth movement. The other thing that I do is I'll then run the cotton bud up the lateral aspect of the cheek teeth. And again, I'm checking to make sure it moves nicely, that it's not sticking, that the guinea pig isn't starting to really vocalise a set point that might indicate, you know, we've got a spike going off into the mucosa. So again, that's a good thing to be doing. So apart from checking that whether the cotton snags or not. The other thing that I do, which might sound a bit strange, but once I've cleaned the mouth out with the cotton buds, I then do a sniff test of the cotton buds. Because remember, grass and hay smell very sweet. Infection from spurs and spikes with, you know, abscessation, well, that definitely smells less sweet. So the cotton buds are a very good tool and can tell you quite a bit. And once the mouth is cleaned out, you can look in with the otoscope. Now, there'll still be food present, but at least there'll be enough clearance that you can actually see a bit better what you're doing. And when I'm teaching students to do this, the biggest mistake that they make is to push the otoscope tip in too far, and then they can't see anything because you're butt up against the gingiva. And that obviously can be painful and cause discomfort and distress to the patient. So, you know, if in doubt or you haven't looked in many mouths, well, first of all, use a metal cone because they chew on the plastic, but do a sort of visual pre-measure to see how long the diastema is, and that lets you know how far to insert the cone of the otoscope. So if you feel once you've looked in the mouth that there may be a problem, or that you definitively can't rule one out but the clinical signs and the history all point towards dental disease, then really the next stage is to take the plunge and to do an examination under a general anaesthetic. Now, if I have a patient who is thin, dehydrated, hasn't been eating well for a few days, or appears very painful, then I always, always, always provide supportive care prior to an anaesthetic. And I can't overemphasize that enough. Only once I feel my patient is stable will I then progress to anaesthesia. You are more likely to lose patients under anaesthetic if you don't stabilize them first. So what do we mean by stabilization? Well, ensuring that the patient is normothermic, that's always something that's very important to check when you have a patient coming in with dental disease. They can often get quite cold, and hypothermia is very commonly seen. Providing appropriate analgesic. Although I would say, obviously, care with meloxicam and other non-steroidals if the rodent is dehydrated, so just as you would a dog or cat. I usually often go for buprenorphine as in a subcutaneous injection for analgesia, and once my patient's hydrated and I've no concerns over the kidneys, then I'll add in meloxicam at that stage. Syringe feeding with critical care food. So obviously you've got lots of different companies that make your herbivore critical care formulas, Oxbow, Burgess, Emerade, all very good companies. And, you know, the one thing I would say is, as we said, gut stasis can be a presenting sign, particularly with the strychomorphs. So I do always start on prokinetic therapy to try and reduce the risk of the development of GI stasis. So that's your ranitidine, cisapride, metoclopramide, etc. So just a picture of a chinchilla here in the correct position for a clinical exam under anaesthetic. Just to comment how yellow the incisors are, that's perfectly normal. Unfortunately, in rodents, intubation is really very tricky under anaesthetic, or to maintain, I should say, anaesthetic, mainly due to their small size, and also it's very difficult to actually visualise their glottis as well. So unlike my rabbit dentals, where I intubate every single patient, for rodents, I tend to go with a light sedation and then a chamber induction and maintain on inhalation anaesthetic. As you can see here, my nurse holding my anaesthetic over the nose of the patient. This little chinchilla just sitting in a induction chamber. So I quite like midazolam and buprenorphine in combination to provide just a light sedation, just to relax them a little bit before inducing in a chamber with inhalation anaesthetic. As the patient does often urinate during this part, We always put a paper towel down on the floor of the induction chamber just to stop them getting covered in their own urine. You can cover the box with a towel, but obviously do keep a check on the patient to make sure that they're coping with the anaesthetic. Dimming the lights, dimming the sound levels, all very useful to reduce the stress on the animal. I also do prefer using sevoflurane for induction over isoflurane, although to be fair, if you don't have access to sevoflurane, both do seem to have irritant effects on the rodents. We do see a lot of salivation, particularly in chinchillas and guinea pigs, with both sevo and iso. And we can also notice them pawing of their at their eyes. So, you know, both, although sevo gets a better press, both do seem to cause some irritant effects. So to ensure that, you know, the mouth is examined thoroughly, you really need to have the proper equipment. So, you know, I would say that if you are seeing a lot of these patients, you know, even a couple a month, to make your life easier, it is worthwhile to invest in the appropriate equipment. So we'll just have a little run through the different types of dental equipment that we can see. So, you can buy specific packs. There's a number of companies that sell rodent dental packs. To be fair, I only use about two items from those packs. So buying, you know, items individually and creating your own is also not a bad option. This is just a regular dental kit that we have. If you don't have access to a dental framework, which we'll get to in a moment, but this is just an incisor gag that we have. Incisors go either side there, and this is cranked open by turning this to spread the mouth open. Cheek dilator is extremely useful. You want them fairly tightly sprung so that it actually stays in position in the mouth. Spatula, this is probably my most useful piece of equipment when doing dentals, especially when I'm burring. It helps to keep the tongue out the way. And then we also have probes, making sure that we're not missing any pockets around the teeth. These are obviously for grasping and removing teeth. And this is designed more for rabbits as an incisor removal, not something we do commonly in rodents at all. Then we have this dental burr. So it's a rotating low-speed dental burr. The edge is roughened. We'll just get our arrow back. So the edge of the tip is roughened there. This is what I use probably 90% of the time for reducing the crown height of cheek teeth. And then next to it, obviously, we've got our diamond-shaped disc used for shortening incisors. So just a photo to sort of show a typical setup. Those that are eagle-eyed will notice this is a rabbit, not a chinchilla or a guinea pig, but you get the idea. This one wasn't intubated, but again, get the idea of how, which is why I included the picture of how the setup is with the your nurse is sort of sat down monitoring the patient either with Doppler on for heart rate or a stethoscope in place. We always have a thermometer to monitor body temperature, and we've got a dental frame here and it's on a heated towel. You can see that I've got a head torch on to promote my visibility, and using my spatula alongside my burr to keep all the soft tissue structures out of the way. So dental tables are very lovely. Your nurses will like them. It will save them from getting a sore hand to actually hold an incisor gag. But obviously the middle photo there is the more, here we go, the middle photo here. That's your traditional incisor gag. Whereas we've got two different types of tables here, and the incisors hook over each of these bars and then obviously can be spread to open the mouth. This one here comes with its own LED light as well, which is a useful addition. So dental tables, I would say if you are doing rabbit dentals or rodent dentals with any frequency, these certainly make your life a bit easier. And the one on the left, actually, that grey on it has a heat mat. So again, helps to keep your patients nice and toasty. So part of the diagnosis, you know, as well as just looking in the mouth, not only with your eye, but with magnification of an otoscope, you can also use an endoscope. So, you know, don't forget if your practice has an endoscope, then we use it for every single one of our, anything smaller than a Netherland dwarf. I have good eyesight, but equally I could miss things at the back of the mouth. So what I like to do is before my dental, I have a look with the endoscope, and then after my dental, I have another look. And that makes sure that I'm comfortable. I haven't missed anything in the mouth. So, you know, magnification is nice. And if you have the toys, do use them. So just another view, one of my older colleagues, or old colleague, I should say, she's not that old, and she's using the endoscope here and getting a nice view of the upper arcades of, I think that's a guinea pig by the looks of it. So you can get some very nice images using endoscopy. And again, an endoscopy image just showing some medial spikes starting, not currently causing any ulceration to the tongue, but wouldn't be long before they do. So obviously these need to be dremeled back to a more appropriate length. And then a couple to show. So this is a guinea pig. You can see here we've got the start of this elongation of this visible crown. It really should come to only about this level here. And we've got a sharper edge starting to encroach over the tongue, which if it does so on the other side as well, we're getting entrapment to the tongue. And at the wear points, we'll start to get an ulcer forming. Guinea pig mouth again, and you can see that we've got a distortion on this side with almost an instepping of the lower right premolar, again resulting in dental overgrowth. Okay, so for confirming your dental disease, as well as looking at what's going on in the mouth, do remember the old iceberg effect. So often what we see, there's a heck of a lot that's happening beneath. And in practice, when you're don't have access to CT because only the referral institutes really do, radiography is an extremely useful tool, and one that I used to use a lot of. So I've been superseded a little bit now with CT, but equally for client budgets, radiography is often very doable. A few views that you can take. I mean, in an ideal world, dorsiventral, your two laterals, your two obliques, and a rostrocaudal, that would be lovely. We sort of charge per sort of skull series, so it's a bit more affordable for our owners. But if you're charging per plate, then obviously doing all these views can rapidly add up. I would say that if you're going to the expense of doing radiographs, unless you have a guinea pig who's quite placid, in which case we do conscious skull radiographs in those chaps, but everyone else, certainly your degus and chinchillas, to get diagnostic quality radiographs, I would give a little bit of anaesthetic to, or a little bit of sedation. If I had to pick, then my oblique views are extremely useful, and also lateral views as well. But obviously in an ideal world, you'd be doing as many of these views as the owner was able to afford. So a lateral view here, and what we can see, if we just get our arrow, so you can see that we've got a bit of a bluntening of the end of this lower incisor. It looks a bit sort of boxy rather than chisel shaped, and the teeth, it's not come across quite well, this radiograph, but hopefully you can see we've got an increase in periodontal space between the teeth. We've got the start of a spike coming forward at this point, and overall just not the best looking mouth. So this is one that's sort of a mild to moderate level of dental disease. Again, this view we can see, this is guinea pig here, I should have said, and we can see, get our little arrow again. It's got a mind of its own. There we go. So you can see that what's happened here is, yes, we've got the chisel shape of the lower incisor, but it's hitting the wrong point of the upper incisor, so we've got this sort of corrugation look to it here. And then, we've got quite a clear lack of a tooth at this point, not opposing correctly on the upper side. So, the dental X-rays can be extremely useful not only for staging your dental disease, but also for monitoring progression. And once you know that you have dental disease present, at least X-rays every sort of 6 to 12 months would then be advisable. Client finance permitting. Again, apologies for this being a rabbit, but just to show you the sort of angle that we're aiming at for oblique view. And obviously, in this rabbit patient here, you can see that we've got elongation of the reserve crown going down into the ventral mandible. Now, what I would say is that for imaging, if you're not sure what you're seeing, there are a number of very good imaging books available. The BSAVA manuals are always very good as a reference guide. And there's a very nice, it's Exotic Companion Mammals clinical radiology book as well. So, if again, if you're seeing these cases, it is worthwhile investing in some literature to help you decide what you're seeing. Just a very quick word on this, because obviously it's not very practical in general practice, but we do a lot of CT scans here at Edinburgh. It's actually, if we were charging per plate, it works out cheaper than a full skull series. We have a very good rate that we do CT scans. But apart from guinea pigs, which I would contemplate doing conscious, all other rodent species we do under anaesthetic. Otherwise, they're not going to hold still for nice views to be seen. This is a chinchilla. You'll appreciate looking at the chinchilla there that we have very beautiful, big, gas-filled tympanic bulla, much bigger than, in rabbits and guinea pigs. This is a cross-section, a longitudinal cross-section of the skull. So you can see that we've got the incisor on the upper side, incisor on the lower side. And chinchilla is the lower mandibular incisor, extends almost back to the point of the first premolar, whereas it only goes about two-thirds of the way of the diastema on the maxillary incisor. The angle that we expect to see, so a nice straight line here, and that's in keeping with the oblique angle of the occlusal surface of the chinchilla. And just a little 3D skull model as well, just for a little bit of entertainment. So CT is very useful, and I would say that if you have a patient that you think, has ongoing dental disease of which you want to know exactly which teeth are affected, whether there's any signs of early abscessation, then referral for CT is a consideration. So what's our treatment for dental disease? Well, we can bur the teeth. We could potentially extract the teeth, and obviously, if we've got secondary abscessation development, then abscess removal surgery is warranted as well. So for incisor burring, so back to the picture we had of our little hamster friend from earlier. This little one basically had. Let's see, my little arrow likes to play up a little bit. There we go. So we can see that we've got a fairly normal lower right incisor, but the lower left is very long and very skewed. So this little chap had to come in every month to have a very quick general anaesthetic. He was otherwise in very good body condition, very good health. The procedure took less than 2 minutes, and it was just a bit easier for him to do that under anaesthetic. He held still. That said, this is a little rat who we're using obviously the rotating diamond disc Dremel. Got him wrapped in a bunny burrito with just a syringe in the mouth to protect the tongue and other soft tissue structures, and a very quick zap of the incisor. Now, if you have a very relaxed rat, this is something that you could do conscious. Certainly that applies to chinchilla and guinea pigs as well. Degus tend to be a bit more wriggly, so I generally would anaesthetise them for this procedure. And as we've said, you know, when we are thinking about anaesthesia, making sure that the patient is otherwise, you know, bright and well will significantly reduce any risk associated with that. For your boring of the cheek teeth, so here we have a case where this little guinea pig, so we're on a dental frame, we've got our anaesthetic over the nose, inhalation anaesthesia, I'm using my spatula in to keep the tongue out of the way, and I've got my cheek dilators in as well. So my visualisation is going to be very good, and what I'm needing to do is basically to burr down the heights of this visible crown of the not only the first premolars on both bottom sides, but also the molars as well. So we've said that this is the normal sort of pattern of the occlusal surface, a bleak angle, and then on the right this is the entrapment. Now, rather sadly, the picture of the previous little chap, this is actually his jaw. Because the owners decided they did not want to treat, they didn't want the ongoing dental issues, of which he'd had a number of dentals, but we explained it was going to be management rather than cure. So they donated his body for a teaching post-mortem, and we were able to prepare the skull and use that as a teaching aid. So what we can see from this skull, we basically have quite considerable elongation, as we said, of the premolars. We have, see if my arrow's working. There we go. So, you know, the tongue was quite clearly trapped in under there. He was losing a lot of body condition. Looking down in a dorsoventral manner, you can see just how these teeth sort of sweep into a narrow point. So therefore, any overgrowth of this area, we have a really narrow little column. And then, you know, instead of being nicely down the line, following the angle of the mandible, we've got this reaching up almost like a ski jump style. So a bit of a sad case, that one, but prevented the little chap from any further suffering and also from, you know, requiring repeat dental burring procedures. So what do we need for dental burring? Well, steady hand is extremely important. So I always rest my wrist. I never sort of hover my hand when I'm doing dental burring. Even if it's resting one hand against the other, I make sure that my I'm right-handed, so I use my left hand to stabilise my left hand. Whenever we've burred for any length of time, you need to stop. You need to intermittently cool the surface of the tooth with cotton buds, wet cotton buds. Because we can't pack the mouth in these guys because they're not intubated, we can't use, you know, water spray, otherwise we're likely to get them to aspirate and choke. So just controlled amount of water on cotton tips is ideal. Very important to use your spatula and your cheek dilators to keep all those soft tissue structures out of the way. The last thing that you want to do is to cause, you know, further soft tissue trauma. And then something that's often overlooked is when we are doing these dentals, particularly the ones that are quite complex or time consuming, the mouth is sort of prized open using these dental frames or incisor gags. And as a result, you know, the mouths of rodents is very small in terms of the commissure size. So, you know, if we're artificially opening these mouths wide, we can give them very sore masticatory muscles. So I have my nurses time me that every 3-4 minutes I close the mouth for 30 seconds, a minute, and allow it to rest before opening the mouth again. And I do find I have to, you know, tell my nurses to tell me off on that, because sometimes I just want to crack on and and get the dental done, but I have found to my patient's detriment that the times that I do that without allowing rest periods, they do take a lot longer to get back to full appetite and eating. I can't overemphasize rather enough the importance of not rasping. Not rasping and not cutting teeth. We do see a lot of referrals here, although we have our own first opinion service, but a lot of the referrals are dental issues that have perhaps been made worse by the use of inappropriate instrumentation. The problem we have with rasping is that the actual force that you're required to put on the tooth, is quite vast, and so it loosens the tooth. We damage the ligaments. At worst case, we can see fracturing, and ultimately, if the teeth are loose, their angles of growth can alter. We can then have malocclusion. We can have infection tracking down between the teeth as well. And realistically, in this photo on the right, how long would that take you by rasping to correct that problem? Now, obviously, in this little chap, I didn't do the burring on him, but in many cases where I have patients that present like this, that's a good sort of 10 minutes of burring per side to get everything back into normal alignment. And that's burring with a high-speed Dremel that's a lot kinder to the teeth than rasping would be. So realistically, you can only do a little bit with rasping without, causing severe and significant damage. Cases like the one on the right, so this little chap had been needing dentals every 2 months. His problem was not just diet. We managed to correct that, although diet had caused the initial issue, but he did have a secondary malocclusion, and as a result, even with the best diet, he wasn't going to improve to such an extent that we could prevent him needing further dentals. So dental surgery, well, unfortunately, that's, it's a whole webinar in itself, and I'm probably just starting to run a little bit over on time as well. So just a very quick summary of what procedures are sort of doable. Incisor removal, well, personally, I would be really very, very wary of attempting that in the myomorphs. So in the myomorphs, the mandibular incisors, so the lower incisors, they extend to the level of or even distal to the last molar. So that means that they extend for pretty much the majority of the mandible, whereas the upper incisors, well, it depends on the species, but they can extend from sort of 2/3 to 3/4 of the diastema length. For the histricomorphs, the degus follow sort of a similar pattern of incisor pattern to the myomorphs, with these really long mandibular reserved crowns or roots. But the chinchilla and the guinea pig incisors, they extend almost to the level of the first premolar on the mandibular aspect. And the maxillary incisors extend to the level of half of the diastema in chinchillas. And guinea pigs are a bit more similar to rabbits, with extension of the reserved crown to the level of the sort of mesial aspect of the first premolar. So the closeness of the upper incisors to the nasal cavity means that, we're likely to get fistulas developing. They're highly likely if we're attempting this incisor removal. And so for these reasons, incisor removal should really be a very carefully considered procedure, and it's ultimately really not one that I would be recommending. Your extraction of cheek teeth, well, it's similar to in rabbits. You have a limitation of the area of the mouth that you can get access to, and what we do find is that, unless the tooth is very wobbly, in which case, perhaps you can remove it intraorally, but often you have to go extraorally and remove the tooth, surgically. So just a few pictures of some abscess surgery, and like I say, dental surgery is a webinar all to itself, but just to go over a few of the pictures. So these patients all developed mandibular tooth root abscesses. The top left, you can see that we've got a well circumscribed abscess on the ventral aspect of a mandible. The bottom left shows that exposed abscess still contained within the capsule. And just like in rabbits, you're aiming to remove as much of the capsule as you know as possible. The top right, so we can see the molar socket after we've got extraoral crown extraction following the removal of an abscess. So we've basically gone in ventrally, removed the tooth by sort of drilling up through the ventral mandible. And then the little kind of cream dots that you can see there, antibiotic impregnated beads. And they've been placed at the site to try and prevent recurrence of infection. Now, impregnated beads, they're not something that I use with every case, but if I feel there was incomplete abscess removal, then obviously that would fall under the deciding criteria. And although dental extraction sites or abscess sites can be left open to heal using our marsupialization technique, the bottom right picture just shows your routine sort of closure with Monocryl using a simple continuous intradermal pattern. So just to finish up the webinar, I think the thing that I would always say is, you know, prevention is definitely better than cure. If you can, you know, if you've got a suitable number of owners, having an owner's night or even producing an article in a newsletter or some client advice handouts that you can give or have available on your website is certainly very useful as to the importance of good diet and the importance of, you know, being aware of the signs to look out for. In terms of the owners being aware of their pet's behaviour, so as I said, you know, client education, extremely important, and, you know, awareness of what clinical signs, you know, we see that are associated with dental disease. So just a very sort of brief skip through rodent dentistry and hopefully a few practical tips that you can you know put into practice, but if anyone has any questions now, I'd be more than happy to answer.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Jenna for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.